So you want a king, huh? I'm going to try to talk you out of that this morning. There are some people today who are proponents of having a monarchy, having a king or a rule over us. And they reason that, well, it couldn't be worse. I'm not trying to put words in their mouths, but that it couldn't be worse, couldn't be a form of worse government than we have today. After all, look at where we are today. So if we had a king that could rule and just kind of make rules and make law and just straighten this thing out, it'd be a good thing. If we just had a godly king, they would say, then things would be good. And, you know, I don't disagree with that. I agree. If we had a godly king and a wise king, somebody that actually knew how to rule men, because every godly person doesn't know how to rule men. But if we had a good and godly king, yeah, that they're right. It would be a lot better than what we have today. But the key word there is if, right? If we had a godly king. If you look in 2 Samuel 23 and verse 3, David here says what a godly king should be. In 2 Samuel 23 and verse 3, it says, "The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spake to me, he that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." We haven't had that for quite some time. Our previous president, George W. Bush, pretended to be ruling in the fear of God. He said all the right things, and a lot of them say the right things, but what they do is completely different. You can say, "Praise Jesus, hallelujah," all you want while you're dropping carpet bombs and murdering, mass murdering a million people overseas, but your faith, or your faith, yeah, doesn't match up with your works. The works don't prove the faith, do they? But, you know, the same could be said about a Republican form of government. If we had good and godly, wise rulers, and I use Republican with a small r there. I'm not talking about capital R Republican. I mean representative government that are, you know, were represented by congressmen and senators and things like that. But if we had a godly president, senators, congressmen, judges, everything would be great. And that's true, it would be. You could virtually have almost any form of government if you had good and godly people running it, and it'd be probably be okay. I would say socialism and communism would be an exception to that because they don't work with human nature. It just, there's no way to make that system. You could have saints and angels running that system, and it is not going to work. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work because of the incentive problem, and it doesn't work because of the socialist calculation problem either. Because whenever you have socialism and communism and the means of production are owned by the state, they're centrally owned, the state has no prices to figure out what things should be prioritized. So if you want to build a whole bunch of stuff and you only have X amount of concrete, if you don't have a price for that, and whoever just comes first gets all the concrete, well, maybe he could have used something else to build his process that would have been much more efficient. So without pricing structure, socialism will not work. But that's not what I'm preaching on today. But just to give you, that's just your second argument against socialism. Everybody knows about the incentive problem. If everybody makes the same amount of money, then nobody's going to try to work hard, right? That's only one of the problems. The calculation problem is another one. And Ludwig von Mises came up with the calculation problem way back in the 1920s, I think it was. Long before communism, all the communistic experiments failed, he said that they would fail. So why did we go to war against Korea and Vietnam and all these other communist countries? Why did we have the Cold War with Russia and all this? It was completely unnecessary. If you'd have just knew, if you would have known true economic philosophy, we would have known that it's going to fall apart on its own, and there was no reason to go to any of these wars. So, like I said, the issue is not, it's not as much about the type of government as it is about the character of the people and the rulers. Not just the rulers, but the character of the people. You cannot have an ungodly people ruled by some godly rulers and have it work out. Number one, in a representative government, you're not going to have godly rulers very long with an ungodly people, right? It's the whole idea. You elect your rulers and you're going to elect people of your own ilk. People generally get the rulers that they deserve and that they desire, for that matter, but specifically that they deserve. It says in the book of Daniel that God setteth over the kingdoms of men the basest of men. He gets a kick out of it. Oh, yeah? You people want to turn against me? You get a George Bush. How do you like that? Oh, you don't like him? How about a Barack Obama? You don't like him? How about a Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or whoever? But even godly and moral rulers are not a guarantee of a peaceful and prosperous society. Because, for instance, if you had a godly man, and there are plenty of good godly people out there that don't have the foggiest idea about economics, if they've never learned anything about economics, and they think that having a minimum wage is a good thing for the economy, and they think that social welfare programs are good for the economy, and it kind of seems on the face of it, if you don't really think about it, well, yeah, those are all good things. It's good to be taken care of. Everybody should make a living wage. Well, why don't we raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour? We'll all be rich then. Why do we even send foreign aid? We should just go over there and tell their governments, hey, institute a $50 an hour minimum wage, and you'll be rich like we are. It's stupid, right? Everybody, you can see the foolishness of it whenever you raise the minimum wage that high. Well, if a lot of minimum wage creates a lot of unemployment, what does a little minimum wage create? A little bit of unemployment. It knocks the people out of the bottom rungs of the ladder. You know, you can imagine kids that are working for the minimum wage somewhere. If we up the minimum wage to $15 an hour, they're not going to have jobs, right? These companies are going to automate, and rightly so. They can't make a profit otherwise, or else you're going to be paying $8 for a hamburger at McDonald's or something. It doesn't work. Most people don't work minimum wage jobs anyway. It's a very small percentage of the population that works for minimum wage. Most people start off at minimum wage, and then they quickly move on to better jobs where they get paid more, and that's the first rung of the ladder. So it's not heartless people who are against the minimum wage. It is compassionate people who are against the minimum wage because we want to see people get jobs, not be forced out of the labor market. You're getting a whole bunch of stuff that was not in the outline and that I didn't really intend to say, but that's okay. And furthermore, godly leaders that would have a faulty idea of foreign policy, imagine where that could get you. A little bit of intervention here, a little bit of intervention there, and before you know it, we're into the mess that we're in now. But it all seems good. All these poor, oppressed people, we need to help them out. Well, before you know it, you've intervened here, you've intervened there, and then you've got full-scale wars and so on. So it's not only a godly person, but a wise person. And I'll tell you what, you give me a wise unbeliever over a godly, foolish person any day. Now, maybe godly, foolish person is a contradiction in terms, I don't know, but give me a wise person who understands economics and who understands foreign policy, who may be an unbeliever, but you know what? He knows how to rule. He knows how to put the country on the right track. I'd take him over a so-called believer who doesn't have a clue about that stuff, but who's good intentioned. You know where good intentions lead, right? Highway to hell is paved with good intentions, they say. No different than, you know, am I going to go to a doctor that is a good and godly Christian who's, you know, got a D in med school and he's a nice guy, he means well, but he doesn't really know what he's doing? Or am I going to go to the unbeliever who got an A in med school and really knows what he's doing? I'm going to go to the guy that knows what he's doing. You know, I'm not going to his church. I'm not going to him for spiritual counsel. I'm going to him for natural things. Jesus said the children of this generation are wiser in their generation, or the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. Well, that's just the way it goes sometimes. So here's the issue. Given the corrupt fallen nature of man and the fact that power corrupts, as the quote goes, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, given that fact, then you'd be much better off to not invest, or not to vest, all the power in one person. Because that's the nature of power. You give somebody ultimate power, and there are very, very few people that could handle that. Most people would not be able to handle that. And it would corrupt even the best of people. So that's why it's best to have distributed power, like the founders created, where you have the judicial branch, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and these branches supposedly all are supposed to be, you know, checking and balancing one another. What happens in practices is they all collude together and screw us. But anyway, it works out for a while anyway. You know, it's good. I mean, the Constitution was a pretty decent document. I don't think it's flawless, but it was a pretty good deal, right? And it worked for a while, and then it eventually gets corrupted. So anyway, better not to invest all the power in one man. Let's look at Proverbs 28 and verse 16. But I'm going to make my case for this even more so. I know I've just been kind of reasoning with you at this point, but I'm going to give you some Bible for this as well, a whole chapter of the Bible for that matter. First, in Proverbs 28 and verse 16, it says, "The prince that wanteth understanding." Now, when you're reading the King James Bible, you have to make sure that you understand how the words were used in 1611. Whenever we use the word want, we think of desiring, right? That is not the primary definition of the word, and that's not what the King James means when it says that. It does not say the prince that desireth understanding is a great oppressor. No. The prince that desires understanding would be a good prince, right? The prince that wanteth understanding is also a great oppressor. Want means to lack. The prince that doesn't have understanding is what this is saying, is a great oppressor. But he that hateth covetousness shall prolong his days. Let me jump back. That hating covetousness just reminded me of a verse that I wanted to give you and I forgot. If you turn back to Exodus 18 and verse 21, we saw there in 2 Samuel 23:3 that David said that he that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. So if you had a godly monarch ruling in the fear of God, that'd be a good form of government. But also, if you had a godly distributed government, that would also be a good government. I'll give you a verse for this. In Exodus 18 and verse 21, Moses here had been ruler over the people of Israel. And he had been a micromanager. He had been doing everything all by himself. And he had a nation of a million people or something, and they're all coming to him for judgment. I mean, I can't even imagine. It's hard enough. You have a pastor, a couple of churches of 20-some people, and if all of you were coming to me with matters of judgment all the time, I'd be overwhelmed. Imagine if you had a million. But anyway, so Moses had a father-in-law who was not exactly a Christian, per se, at all, but his name was Jethro, not tall, but just Jethro. And in verse 21, he came up with a good recommendation here for Moses. And Moses was smart enough to listen to this guy. Even though Moses was the top guy, right? Jethro is just some dude. You know, God didn't ordain Jethro, but yet Moses listened to Jethro because Jethro had a good idea. So you never want to throw away somebody's good idea or just shove it off to the side because he might be your lesser. You know, it doesn't matter to me if a 5-year-old kid comes up and says, "Hey, you know, whatever. I can't think of anything that a 5-year-old kid would tell." But anyway, if he had something good to say that was wise, well, hey, I'd certainly take it. Verse 21. It says, "Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties and rulers of tens." So a distributed type government. Granted, I mean, it is a hierarchical system where you kind of like a military system almost, where you have, you know, in the military you'll have a company commander over 100 people, and then you'll have a battalion commander over several companies and a brigade commander over several battalions and so on. But anyway, still distributed. Now, you don't have one guy at the top that's the absolute dictator over everything. And Moses took his advice, and it worked out well for him because Moses was about ready to burn himself out. But this is, I mean, look at the wisdom of this man, though. I mean, if I was going to recommend good and godly leaders, I think I'd go right to Exodus 18 and verse 21. "Men that fear God, men of truth, hate and covetousness." That would be a good leader. And not many of ours fit those characteristics, do they? No. I think the opposite of those things are almost requirements for the job, it seems like. Now, if hundreds of years of European history isn't enough to dissuade the proponents of monarchy, then hopefully what the Bible says will be. Because if you know some European history, it wasn't exactly a utopia under the European monarchical system. So let's turn back. Well, first of all, before we turn back, I'm just going to give you some history about Israel. During Israel's history, after they came out of the land of Canaan, Joshua ruled over them after Moses died. Joshua took them into the land. And then after Joshua's death, God set up a system of judges where you would have a judge that would rule over Israel. And Israel would end up getting themselves into trouble with God. They would turn their backs on God. He would turn them over to a foreign power. And then they would cry unto the Lord, and the Lord would raise up judges among them, like Samson and Jephthah and Samuel and some other ones. And those judges would deliver Israel. This was God's system. And this happened, this lasted for 450 years. Look at Acts 13 and verse 20. Acts 13 and verse 20. These judges would generally have lifetime appointments. The kings of Israel generally had lifetime appointments unless they were killed or something like that. And that's one thing as I read through the book of Kings that I'm thankful in our system that we have limited it to 2 terms, because that's about all I can take. Actually, two minutes would be plenty, but 2 terms at least. By the time 8 years is up, I mean, when George Bush's 8 years were up, I was so ready for him to go. I was almost welcoming Obama. Well, Obama's 8 years are up, and I'm so ready for him to go. I'm not welcoming Hillary Clinton, but I could welcome Donald Trump. I realize he's certainly not going to be perfect, but wow, I'm so tired of Obama. That's just how it goes anyway. But can you imagine if he had a lifetime presidency? Oh my goodness, it would be horrible. So the Lord is still shining down on us from heaven, apparently, by he's taking these guys out after 8 years. But Acts 13 and verse 20, it says, "And after that he gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet." So 450 years, this system worked reasonably well. If Israel would have just quit rebelling against the Lord, it would have worked out great. I mean, they would have had a very nice system, but it's summed up pretty well. I think it's in the last book or the last verse of Judges when it says that there was no king in the land or no magistrate in the land, and in those days every man did what was right in his own eyes. That was pretty much how things worked in the Judges. If they would have done the ways of the Lord, though, they would have been just fine. But during this time, Israel had no king, no human king anyway. And the reason was because God was their king. Look in Isaiah 43 and verse 15. Isaiah 43 and verse 15. Isaiah 43 and verse 15. It says, "I am the Lord, your Holy One, the Creator of Israel, your King." So God was their king during this time. And this is the only type of monarchy that is desirable, in my opinion, anyway. And I think most of you would agree with that. Every one of us would be a monarchist if we're talking about God ruling over us, right? Like he did to Israel. Of course, anybody that's opposed to that form of monarchy is not a Christian, certainly. It's a reprobate. Now, I found that when confronted with this info, some people will do the old switcheroo and say, "Well, I'm really talking about God being the monarch or whatever." And then, you know, that's okay with me. But when we're talking about a human monarch, I don't think that's wise, and I'll give you the reasons. 1 Samuel 8 is the reasons, basically, for that. So, Israel clamored for a king. So they had gone 450 years without one. And now, all of a sudden, turn back to 1 Samuel 8 and verse 1, Israel now wants a king. Now remember, they already had a king. God was their king, and they had judges, and the Lord delivered them from their enemies with the judges, so they didn't need a king to be delivered from their enemies or anything. God showed over and over again. They didn't need a king, but they want a king. So Samuel gets old, and in 1 Samuel 8 and verse 1, Samuel gets old, and his sons then take over in his stead. It says, "And it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel." Now, this was not a wise move on Samuel's part because, as we will see, Samuel's sons were not good men. They didn't follow after Samuel. It'd be like a pastor deciding to ordain his sons to go off and pastor his church or other churches or whatever. Never, ever do that unless your sons are actually called to the ministry. You wouldn't just say, "Oh, I want my boy to follow in my footsteps." No way. Let's look at verse 2 and 3. It says, "Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, and in the name of his second, Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes, and perverted judgment. So I don't know why, I'm assuming Samuel knew this, why he would have appointed his sons in that case, I don't know. But these guys, they would have made good politicians in 2016 America, wouldn't they? They took bribes, perverted judgment, and turned aside after lucre. That's pretty much what politicians do, you know. They don't go in there to make the $160,000 salary or whatever it is in the House or the Senate. They go in there for all the perks and the junkets and especially all the money they make after they get out. Because once they get out, then they go to work for the banks, or they go to work for the military industrial complex, and they get some big cushy job in some great big corporation somewhere, whom they have passed off contracts to when they were a congressman because these guys lobbied them. They know what they're doing. They know that there's going to be big time money in it for them after they get out. Hillary Clinton made millions and millions of dollars giving speeches. I mean, I've heard her speak. I wouldn't pay hundreds of thousands of dollars per speech, let me tell you what. But how much you want to bet when Barack Obama gets out of office, he's not raking in millions and millions of dollars for giving speeches to who knows what, the World Bank, the IMF, Goldman Sachs, or who knows where. These guys, they know where their bread's buttered. But anyway, I could talk about that all day. You ought to listen to Thomas Massie sometime, congressman from Kentucky. When he said, here's how the thing works. He was a junior congressman. He comes in, and the first thing they do is the lobbyists come up to you, and they say, okay, you need to join the club, basically. I forget what it's called. And the only problem is the dues are, I think it was 100 grand a year to join the club. He's like, 100 grand a year? Who's got 100 grand? No problem. Here's the name of this office and this office and this office. Go here and talk to these people. They'll give you the funds and everything, and they'll, you know, make the contributions or whatever, and then you can be in the club and everything. And he's like, well, what if I don't want to do that? Well, that's fine. You'll never get a piece of legislation passed. You'll never be on any committees. You'll never be, you know, you'll totally be blacklisted and blah, blah, blah. That's how they do it. So then these guys, they're beholden to the guys that are giving them the money so that they can join the club. Most people don't even know that kind of stuff. They, you know, they have a naive view of how government works. But anyway, okay, I really got to stop with the rabbits. I got to stay on point here. So Samuel's sons are wicked and they're corrupt. You know, it's essential for ministers to have well-behaved children. Look at Titus 1 and verse 6. This is what I said earlier when I said that I'm going to draw out some parallels here for us in the New Testament. I like to do this when I'm preaching in the Old Testament to help us learn some things by precept or example or something from the Old Testament. In Titus 1 and verse 6, this is actually more of instruction for me than it is for you, but Titus 1, 6, it says here that Paul's telling Titus to ordain elders in every city as he had appointed him. He says in verse 6, and if any be blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly. So for a man to be considered for the ministry, he has to have faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly. In other words, he has to have well-behaved children, or he cannot be considered for the ministry. If I was ever looking at a man for the ministry, you better have some well-mannered, well-behaved kids. Because otherwise, that's just one of the qualifications that that would bar you from being in the pastorate. The thing is, and I've said this before, but you notice these words here. Like in verse 7, for a bishop must be blameless. You read down through this list of qualifications for the ministry, and here's what you remember. All Christians should be these things, but a pastor must be these things. These are not just things that don't apply to anybody else. I mean, is that saying the rest of you can be blamed? Right? The rest of you can have kids that are, you know, hog wild and crazy? Can the rest of you be given to wine? Can the rest of you be soon angry? Can you guys all be strikers? And can you be given to filthy lucre? Can you be unjust and drunkards and unholy and intemperate? I mean, you read through that list. Of course not. All of you should be these things, but I have to be these things. I must be these things. And somebody that if I was ever looking for as a candidate for the ministry, he must be these things. Look at 1 Timothy 3, 4 through 5. 1 Timothy 3, 4 through 5. Paul here is giving the qualifications for a bishop again, parallel text to the Titus verse there. He says, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. Gravity means weight, influence, or authority. A father is supposed to be a man of authority, have your children in subjection. Your kids ought to be afraid of you. Whenever you say something, they ought to be afraid of that. If a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the house of God? And here's the principle. This is why a guy's got to have his own house in order. If you can't take care of your own kids, if you've got 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 kids, whatever, if you can't take care of your own kids, how in the world are you going to take care of a church? Especially if it was a larger church. This is what Paul is saying here. Now I know that some of you, and you've told me so, are going to be watching me like a hawk whenever I have kids, Lord willing, someday. Amen, I know. And you know what? That's okay with me. Go ahead. Watch me like a hawk. But you know what Jesus said? Watch and pray. Now this is a totally different context. Watch me like a hawk, but pray for me. Right? Because everybody else is going to be watching me like a hawk too. I'm supposed to be your example in faith and conversation and charity, so on. And I will do my best with the help of God to be a good example to you. But I don't mind if you watch me. Go ahead. Watch me. Scrutinize me. Point things out to me. I really don't care. Go ahead. I'm not worried about it. If I need corrected, go ahead and correct me. And if you're watching me like a hawk, that means you're at least paying attention. So that's good. That's good. If you're going to pay attention, I'm happy to hear that. And the thing is, you better hope that I practice what I preach. Because if I don't practice what I preach, you ain't going to have a preacher anymore. The bishop must be these things. So if you're hoping for me to fail so you can see, oh, it's not as easy as you think, well, go ahead and hope for me to fail. You're going to have another preacher, apparently. So let's think about that. I know you're not hoping for me to fail. But I know you're hoping for me to see that it's harder than I think. I know you are that. Samuel was not the only man, the only great man, though, that had bad kids. This was an epidemic. Maybe epidemic is too strong of a word, but this did not happen infrequently in the Old Testament, let me put it that way. Eli's sons were vile, and it says that he restrained them not, and God judged him severely for it. 1 Samuel 3, 12 through 14. 1 Samuel 3, 12 through 14. I can see I'm going to have to change the way that I put together outlines, because I used to say 50 verses was what I'd do for an outline, and now I maybe closer to 40, but sometimes, depending on the sermon, I see that I should probably cut it even down further, because it seems like I have a lot to say about these things, and I want to get them under an hour and a half. It's been too long lately. I'm sure you agree. So anyway, 1 Samuel 3, 12 through 14. It says, in that day, the Lord here is speaking, in that day I will perform against Eli all things which I have spoken concerning his house. When I begin, I will also make an end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth. There's the thing. He was not ignorant of what his kids were doing. He knew it and he didn't do anything about it. Which he knoweth because his sons made themselves vile and he restrained them not. It is a father's job to restrain your children. Don't let them be vile. By this time, I don't know how old these boys were, but they were priests and, you know, fornicating with women coming into the temple and things. So they were of age. I mean, it was probably way too late for Eli to do anything at this point anyway. They had already been corrupted. You got to start early. It says that a father that loveth his son chasteneth him betimes, which means early in life. You got to start nice and early. Start when they're a year old. David was another one that did not restrain his children, and it caused him much hardship. But you know what happened to Eli, right? His sons were killed in battle shortly after this. We went through this just in the Bible studies the last couple weeks. His sons were killed in battle. The Ark of the Lord was taken. And Eli was so taken back by that, he fell backwards in his chair, broke his neck, and died. Eli was severely judged in his household for not restraining his children. But look at 1 Kings 1, 5 through 6. 1 Kings 1, 5 through 6. 1 Kings 1, 5 through 6. Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king, and he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. This is David's son, Adonijah. And his father, this is speaking of David, had not displeased him at any time in saying, why hast thou done so? And he also was a very goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom. David never displeased his son. Fathers, your job, parents, your job is to displease your children. It is to make them unhappy with you whenever they're doing something wrong. You got to tell them no. Give them that good dose of vitamin N. You can be your kid's friend when they get older. You can be Chris's friend now. He's getting to be that age, close to, maybe you don't think so. Anyway, he's getting close to that, right? But you don't want to be your kid's friend when he's 5 or 3 or 8. They're too young for that. You got your whole life to be friends with them, and it'd be better to be friends with a good and godly, virtuous person, wouldn't it, than to be friends with a fool. So don't be friends with them early on. You can be nice to them. I mean, you know, give them positive feedback when they're good and so on. But anyway. So, getting back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, the people come to Samuel and they ask him to make them a king to judge over them like all the nations had. 1 Samuel chapter 8. First Samuel 8, 4 through 5 says, then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, behold, thou art old and thy sons walk in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like the nations. Make us a king. And notice what they want. Why do they want a king? They want a king to judge them like the nations. They want to be like everybody else. You know, peer pressure is not a thing that only teenagers have to deal with and only young children have to deal with. We all have to deal with it. They felt peer pressure from their surrounding nations. They wanted to be just like they were. And the real reason they did this was because of their fear and their lack of faith. Let's go down to verse 12 of chapter 12. 1 Samuel 12 and verse 12. Here's a little commentary on why they decided they wanted to do this. It says, and when ye saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, ye said unto me, nay, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord God was your king. This little tidbit was not given there in 1 Samuel 8. This is why one of the kings of the nations came against them, and now they get afraid. They lose their faith. They say, we need a king like the nations. We need a king to go out and fight our battles for us and to protect us. But you know what? We should never trust in men, including kings, to deliver us. Look at Jeremiah 17 and verse 5. We all get caught up in this. Every election season, every 4 years, people get caught up in this. It's the end of the world because whoever the current jerk is president, and we got to get him out. We got to get somebody else in there to save this country, to make America great again, right? Every 4 years, we're going to put our trust in some man, and he is going to save us. It's not going to happen. The only thing that would save us is godliness, repentance. If my people, which are called by my name, shall turn from their sins and humble themselves, God says, I will heal their land. Rough paraphrase. 1 Chronicles 7:14, I think it is. Jeremiah 17 and verse 5. Jeremiah 17 and verse 5. Thus saith the Lord, cursed be the man that trusteth in man, and maketh flesh his arm, and whose heart departeth from the Lord. It's exactly what Israel was doing. They were turning to a man to save them. Their heart departed from the Lord, who was their king. It's exactly what they're doing. This happened to Israel, or this had a potential to happen to Israel, when Sennacherib, king of Assyria, threatened to destroy Israel. He tried to convince the people to not trust in God to deliver them. Turn back to 2 Kings 18, 29 through 31. You see, this wicked king Sennacherib comes up against Israel and besieges them. And then he sends a messenger in there and he tells them, hey, don't you listen to King Hezekiah. If he tries to tell you the Lord is going to deliver you, don't you listen to him. The gods of the other nations weren't able to deliver them. I've taken out them one after another. And now I'm coming up against you. And they've actually found archaeological evidence for this. They found a cone-shaped thing And it had going around it, around in a circle, it had all the nations that the king of Assyria had destroyed, one after the other. And then it says, and he went up against Jerusalem. And there was nothing more after that. And we'll see why here in just a minute. 2 Kings 18, 29 through 31. It says, thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Hearken not to Hezekiah. For thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me by a present, and come out to me, and then eat ye every man his own vine, and every one his own fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of his cistern. He says, hey, come out here and give me a present. Basically, give me a bribe. Give me, you know, take out, empty your treasuries, and I'll go on my way, and you can go out here and eat all of your, out of your vineyards and your fields and things. But don't trust in Hezekiah, because the Lord is not going to deliver you. That's not going to happen. That's what the king here of Assyria is telling them. But Hezekiah, he trusted in God, and he went to the house of God, and he begged for help and mercy from God in God's house. And this is what I'd recommend to every one of you. If any of you are coming up against something that looks like is going to be your demise or your destruction or something very dangerous to you, and the pastor says, trust in God, here's what you do, and then whoever's telling you this says, no, don't trust in God. You need to take matters in your own hands. Go to the house of God like Hezekiah did. Offer your prayers up to God in the house of God. God says he hears the prayers that are made in his house. 2 Kings 19 and verse 1, and it came to pass when King Hezekiah heard it that he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord. He didn't go to the bottle. He didn't try to drown his sorrows away. He didn't go to drugs. He went to the house of the Lord. And look at verses 14 through 19. And Hezekiah received the letter of the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up into the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord God of Israel, which dwellest between the cherubims, thou art the God, even thou alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. Thou hast made heaven and earth. Lord, bow down thine ear and hear. Open, Lord, thine eyes and see, and hear the words of Sennacherib, which hath sent him to reproach the living God. Of a truth, Lord, the kings of Assyria have destroyed the nations and their lands, and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone, therefore they have destroyed them. Now therefore, O Lord, our God, I beseech thee, save thou us out of his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou art the Lord God, even thou only. He pleads with God and he reasons with God and says, Lord, save us out of his hand so that all the nations can know that you are the true God. That's a good plea deal with God. Whenever you pray to God, remind him, Lord, if you let this happen to me, what are people going to think? What are people going to think? You say that you will not suffer the soul of the righteous to famish. But if I starve to death, or if I have to go out there and beg or something, what are people going to think? Reason with him. He likes that kind of stuff. He says, come, let us reason together. Well, the Lord did deliver them. Turn over to verse 35. 2 Kings 19, 35. Here they are up against impossible odds. They have no idea how this is going to work out. And it says, and it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. One angel killed 185,000 Assyrians in one night. Turned the whole thing around. I don't think old Sennacherib was boasting anymore about how the Lord wasn't going to deliver them out of his hands. We're told in Proverbs 21 and verse 31, the horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. We never want to trust in our military. I think it's a wise thing to have a strong national defense, not a bellicose national offense, but to have a good defense, good idea. But we don't ever want to trust in that. Prepare, but trust in the Lord. Beware of the desire to imitate the heathen. This is exactly what they wanted to do. They wanted to have a king to judge them like the nations. They wanted to be like the heathen. But what are we told in Jeremiah 10 and verse 2? Everybody knows this verse. We always remember it around Christmas time. Learn not the way of the heathen, God tells us. Be not dismayed at the signs of heaven like they're dismayed at them. And we're not supposed to envy sinners. Look at Proverbs 23 and verse 17. Proverbs 23 and verse 17. It says, let not thine heart envy sinners, but be thou in the fear of the Lord all the day long. They looked at their sinner neighbors and they wanted to be like them. They were envying their neighbors. We're not supposed to do that. And it's tempting to do that these days, isn't it? You see all these people out there who are living ungodly and they're getting along a lot better than some of us are. And we look at them and it's pretty easy to envy them. Don't envy them. You're not going to envy them when they're burning in hell and you're comforted up there with the Lord someday. Don't worry about them. They'll get theirs. So Samuel is upset with the people here. He's upset that they're clamoring for a king, and Samuel goes to God about it. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 6. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 6. And I can understand why he would be upset about this. He had judged Israel, I think it was for 40 years, for a long time. I think it was 40. I was looking. I don't see it anyway. But he judged them for a long time. And now they basically, Samuel feels like they have rejected Samuel. But the thing is, God tells them they actually haven't rejected Samuel, though. Verse 6 says, but the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. He's a good example. When something bothers you, go to the Lord in prayer, like the old hymn tells us. Take it to the Lord in prayer. So he takes it to the Lord in prayer. But God tells Samuel that they haven't rejected you, Samuel. They've rejected me. Verse 7. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. The fact that they don't want you, Samuel, and your sons, doesn't mean they've rejected you. They've ultimately rejected me, God says. He's got to remember that. Pastors have got to remember that. The church rejects the pastor if he's doing what he should do, and if he's preaching the truth like he should. They haven't rejected the pastor. They've rejected the Lord who sent the pastor. So then God tells Samuel to go, I missed my point there. We already read 1 Samuel 12 and verse 12, where it says, when the Lord God was your king. God was already their king. I've already made that point. But instead of having God as their king, they want to be like the neighbors. They want to have a king. So God tells Samuel to listen to what they have to say and to give them what they want, but to warn them about the kind of king that they're going to have. This is a very important point, and I'm going to make some mileage out of this here in a minute. But look at verse 9. He says, now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. I've preached this many, many times in this church, that God will give you your own desires as a judgment against you if you turn against His word. And this is exactly what God is saying here. He's saying, give them what they want, but warn them ahead of time. That way, whenever it doesn't work out, they can't come back and say, well, Samuel, why didn't you tell us? He tells them. And then it's going to be on them. Let me just give you a few verses to show you that God gives people their ungodly desires as a judgment against them. Psalm 94 and verse 23. Psalm 94 and verse 23. It says, and he shall bring upon them their own iniquity, and shall cut them off in their own wickedness. Yea, the Lord our God shall cut them off. He'll bring their own iniquity upon them. What do you think is going to destroy this country? Do you think it's going to be some foreign invasion that was unexpected and unprovoked? No, it's going to be our own iniquity. Our own sins are destroying this country. It's being destroyed from the inside out. That's how God does it. Jeremiah 2 and verse 19. Jeremiah 2:19. I mean, the very things that people love are our destruction. People love their fornication, and then you have kids out of wedlock. And then what happens? I mean, the kids end up growing up without fathers, and end up, they're messed up, right? He uses our own iniquity to judge us. Jeremiah 2 in verse 19 says, "Thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backslidings shall reprove thee." You see, this is how God works. It's called natural consequences. And, you know, parents know about that. Sometimes you let your kids go ahead and do something that you've told them not to do and that you know is going to end up hurting them. You wouldn't let them do something that would hurt them permanently or severely or something, but you would let them do something stupid to face the natural consequences. Don't touch the stove. Don't touch the stove. Don't touch the stove. Finally he goes for it. Okay, whatever. Ah, that hurts. Well, yeah, I told you not to touch the stove. That's why. You know, that's natural consequences. As long as it's not going to burn his arm off or something, you know, a little burn on the end of his finger is probably not going to kill him. He's going to remember, don't touch the stove next time. And more importantly, the next time when you say, don't touch the electrical outlet, then maybe he's going to remember, oh yeah, Dad told me not to touch the stove and that hurt. I'm not going to touch the electrical outlet because the electrical outlet is going to do more than hurt. Turn to Jeremiah 6 and verse 19. Jeremiah 6 and verse 19. It says, "Hear, O earth, behold, I will bring evil upon this people, even the fruit of their thoughts, because they have not hearkened unto my words, nor to my law, but rejected it." The fruit of your own thoughts. So be careful what you think, because every action starts out in the mind. It always starts out as a thought. And then when you harbor that thought long enough, you run it around in your mind. Usually then you can end up convincing yourself that it's actually probably a good idea if you consider it long enough. And then before you know it, that thought becomes an action. And then that action, when you do that enough times, that becomes a habit. And then once you do the habit long enough, that becomes, I forget what. And then after that, it becomes a destiny. There's a saying about that. I think you know what I'm talking about. But anyway, eventually, you want to know why you end up down some road with a totally screwed up life? It goes way back. It goes back through the habit. It goes back through the action. It goes back to the thought. It ultimately starts in the mind.
Did you want 2:19, Pastor Jeremiah
2:19? 2:19. Did I not read 2:19? Jeremiah 2:19. I did too. Didn't I read that?
No.
"Thine own wickedness shall correct thee, thy backsliding shall reprove thee." I thought I did. That's the verse I wanted. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's the pastor's job, the minister, I don't know, pastor, I'm kind of using these terms interchangeably when we're talking about Samuel, but it's the minister's job to warn them, which will deliver his soul. So what Samuel is about to do is going to deliver Samuel's soul. Look at Ezekiel 3:17 through 21. And this goes with pastors, because Ezekiel, or the Lord here, is speaking to Ezekiel, and he's telling him to speak to the watchman. And Ezekiel is a watchman. He says in verse 17, "Son of man, I have made thee a watchman over the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word at my mouth, and give them warning from me." This is why I say I take a direct application to myself as a pastor from this text, because what am I called? An overseer. Right? What does an overseer do but watches a flock, right? So, here's what happens. God tells the watchman, you warn these people. You see them heading in the wrong direction, you warn them. And then if they follow you, well and good. They're going to be delivered and you've saved your soul. But if they don't follow the warning, they're going to be punished, they're going to be destroyed or whatever, but at least you've saved your own butt. This is the new Chad version. Verse 18. "When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thine hand." You see, I have a solemn duty when I see a church member going in the wrong direction. If I haven't already told him before, if I don't tell him and he does something or she does something which ends up in their demise or their judgment or something, Their blood is on my hands. I've got to tell them. Yet, verse 19, if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. So if you warn him, yeah, he may do his own boneheaded idea anyway and die in his iniquity, just like he would have if you wouldn't have warned him, but you've delivered your soul. Might sound selfish, but hey, I don't want, if you're going to die, go ahead. I'm not going down with you. I can tell you that much. Verse 20. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness. See, before we're talking about the wicked. Now we're talking about the righteous. We're talking about church members here. When a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die. Because thou hast not given him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he hath done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at thine hand. I've got to warn you. But if I've already warned you, don't expect me to keep warning you. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. Verse 21, nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned. Also thou hast delivered thy soul. So, here's the lesson for the pastor. Just warn everybody. Righteous, wicked, when you see somebody going in the wrong direction, just warn them. If they take heed, good. If they don't, well, at least you delivered your soul. Now, it's not the minister's job to stop church members from doing something foolish, but only to warn them. Look at 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14. Because the thing is, I can't stop you from doing something. Now, if you were going to do something which is an excludable offense or something like that, I still can't stop you, but I can say, look, we're going to put you out of the church if you do this. You know, so, I mean, I have some restrictive power there, but still, I can't stop you. You think about a guy that's 6'5". I mean, if you want to do something stupid, I can't physically restrain you, obviously. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14. It says, now we exhort you, brethren, warn them that are unruly, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, be patient toward all men. So this is why I say that we see parallels that go right back to that Ezekiel passage. Give them a warning. The Lord has made the overseer, the watchman. Well, here, let me just give you a verse. I'll just give you a verse that shows you that Ezekiel 3 is applicable to the New Testament minister. He says in Hebrews 13 and verse 17, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they do what? They watch for your souls, as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. Now, I've preached on various topics in the past. Just one example, money management or dating and preparing for marriage or who knows, any number, marriage, a whole, you know, any number of things. And I've warned the church not to make foolish decisions in these things. Some of them were dire. I mean, the dating and preparing for marriage, you don't take that advice and you go marry an unbeliever, you are going to suffer. I guarantee it. You might get lucky, to use the term, as some have, and the spouse will end up coming around. But don't count on it. So when I preached on various topics and, you know, giving you a warning not to do the foolish thing, if I've already preached on it and you choose to do it anyway, then your blood's on your own head. And the thing is, look, I remember hearing of one pastor when they asked him, Pastor, how do you counsel? And he says, I preach. That's how I counsel. I will counsel you privately if you come to me. You all know this. I'm not knocking on your door. If I see something, an issue, I'll come to you sometimes. But if you're having a problem, especially if I don't know about it, I'm not knocking on your door trying to find out what's going on. I'm not in your business. You come to me, I'm happy to talk to you about it. But how do I counsel? I preach. So if I preached on it, there's your counsel. There's your warning. It's already happened. Thankfully for you, it's on the internet. You can go listen to it again. It's not like you say, I don't remember. There's no cop-out in the internet age. It's there. It's going to be there for all eternity, at least until the world ends. Or I quit paying the hosting fee or something like that. But anyway, more than likely, it's going to be there a long time. Re-listen to the sermon before you make a decision. or ask me. You're going to make a decision on a financial matter? Go back and listen to the sermon, or ask me. You think about dating somebody? Go back and listen to that series, or ask me, better yet. That's what I'd recommend. Now, many times, after I've preached on an issue, and a church member tells me that they're going to do something that was directly contrary to what I've taught from the Scripture, I will say nothing about it to them. I'll nod my head, and I'll let them do whatever they're planning to do. You say, well, that's just vindictive. No, I've told you. I've warned you. I've given you the sermon. I've put it on the website so you can listen to it again. And my phone is on 24 hours a day, and you can call me, text me, email me anytime you want. So if I've told you, and then you come up after the fact and tell me what you've already done, I'm not going to tell you again. I mean, if you've already done it or you've already made up your mind, well, I'll just nod my head and act like it's a good idea. Think it's deceptive? I don't know. Well, I've delivered my soul anyway. So what am I trying to tell you? Pay attention to what I preach. Now, I'm not saying if you come up and ask me before you've decided to make a decision, you're actually seeking counsel, I'm not going to deceive you and you know, give you information contrary to what I preach just to see if you were paying attention. Obviously not. But I'm talking about once the decision has already been made, then you come up after the fact and basically to try to salve your conscience, you tell me what you've already done, hoping that I'm going to say, oh, that's good decision. I might actually pretend like it's a good decision. I don't know. So if this happens in the future, don't take my silence as approval, but as a judgment against you. Remember, don't take my silence as approval. When I'm sitting there nodding my head, you know, when you say, well, yeah, I know the Bible says not to get into debt, but, and then da-da-da-da-da, and I sit there and shake my head, yeah, I can see that. I'm not agreeing with you. All right, so Samuel tells them what kind of king they'll get. Look at 1 Samuel 8. In verse 10. First Samuel 8 and verse 10. I would make an exception to that. If you were going to make a decision which was going to totally wreck your life and cause you to be excluded from the church or something like that, yeah, I would jump in and intervene as much as I could. If you're going to make a decision, it's just going to make you smart for it and you'll learn through experience, well, I'll probably just not say anything. But I wouldn't let you destroy yourself. I'm not a heartless jerk, obviously. I don't know if it's obvious to everybody, but anyway, it's obvious to me. So Samuel tells them what kind of king they're going to get. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 10. And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of him a king. So here we go. We're going to walk down through these next few verses, and here Samuel tells them what kind of a king they're going to get. This is why, and this sermon, I realize, hasn't had a whole lot to do with having a king. It's been on a whole lot of things. But anyway, these are the reasons why I'm not in favor of a monarchy, of having a king. Now, you might say, well, the same things happen under our republic. Well, that's true. That is true. The thing is, they're more likely to happen much quicklier under a king because the king's got the sovereign authority and he can just say, I'm having a draft, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. He is the legislature, he is the judge, right? So it could happen a lot quicklier is my point. All right, so let's go down through these things. Verse 11, the first thing, he's going to institute a draft and he's going to draft your sons into the military to fight his wars. Verse 11, and he said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots. He's going to institute the draft. He's going to take your sons and put them into his military. Sound familiar? Sure does. Next, he's going to set up a socialist state and control the means of production. Look at verse 12. It's neat when you read between the lines here and you kind of take the Old Testament language and you apply it to what it would be today, you see, wow, I mean, it's basically what we have, you know, unfortunately. Verse 12, and he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground, which means to plant his fields, right? To ear his ground, and to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war, and instruments of his chariots. So we got three things here. He's going to appoint leaders over industries. Can you say czars? Which are the captains over thousands and captains over fifties. He's going to have control over agriculture. It says he would set them to ear his ground and to reap his harvest. What do we have? Farm subsidies, right? We got all this stuff now. And he would create a military industrial complex to make his instruments of war and chariots. There in the last part of the verse. No big surprise. The thing is, it took us, 100 years or whatever. It took us a while to get to this point. Could happen much more quickly under a monarch. He would also draft their daughters into the service to be his cooks and bakers and confectionaries. Look at verse 13. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries and to be cooks and to be bakers. So he's going to have the, what was it called in World War II when they had the women that helped out in the, But anyway, he's going to bring the women into it too. You see, this idea of getting the women in the draft, forcing the military into the service, is not new. Unfortunately, it's coming back to this country. You believe it? This country now have women on the front line of combat, can even be in special forces. I mean, you look at what the Bible talks about these soldiers, and I forget who it was, but they became as women. You know, women are not supposed to be out there in combat, right? Women are, they're not built for that kind of stuff. A lot of men aren't built for it, for that matter, but women especially are not built for it. They're made to be tenderly caring for children and things like that, not out there murdering people. And it's awful. Not to mention, what's this going to do to our military? If this isn't the judgment of God against a nation that trusts in their military, and now they turn around and put women on frontline combat. Wow. He would take the best of their land and he would give it to his cronies. Look at verse 14. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. What do we call this in modern day parlance? Eminent domain. He's going to take your land and he's going to give it to his buddies for political purposes. I'm glad we don't have any presidential campaigns that like to use eminent domain to take private property to use for his own personal use. But next, he would institute an income tax to pay his officers and servants. Can you imagine that? Verse 15. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He's going to tax you on the income of your fields, 10%. You think, well, in that case, I want a monarch. Well, this is just how he would start out. I bet you he might take more if you gave him some time. Remember, our income tax started out at, 1% of, 1% of the 1% or something. It was the rich of the rich. We're paying 1%. That's how they get these things started. If in 1913 they would have put a bill out which says, we are going to tax all Americans at 33% of their income, they would have never passed. Actually, that with the how the tax system works, you know that I think almost 50% of people pay no taxes, right? So I mean, the rich do pay the vast majority of it. 75% or more of the taxes are paid by about 10% of the people, I think. And the richer you get, the more and more you pay. So anybody that thinks the rich don't pay their fair share is crazy. They pay plenty. And then people get upset about these corporations who don't pay any income tax. GE doesn't pay any income tax every year. You know what I say about that? Wonderful. I wish all the corporations didn't pay any income tax. That money would go back into research and development. It would pay out to shareholders. It would pay employee salaries or whatever. Good. I don't want any of them to pay any income tax. I'm happy for anybody that can find all the loopholes they can and not pay anything. The next thing he would do is require civil service. And he would take their servants and the best of their young men and he'd put their asses to work. Now you think I'm cursing. I'm actually not cursing. I'm going to read you the verse that says it. He would put their asses to work. I'm telling you. Let me read you the verse. I'm not making this stuff up. Verse 16. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. He would put their asses to work. I'm talking about a donkey. I don't know what everybody's laughing about here. You think I'm up here speaking crudely or something? Would I do something like that? So you'd require civil service. You know, take them and take their servants and make them his. And he would be a totalitarian, and he would institute taxes and slavery, making the people his servants. Verse 17. It says, "And he will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants." Oh, you still want a monarch? I don't want one. I'm free, never been in bondage to any man, right? Isn't that what the Jews say? Oh, I'm kidding. We're not free. We just stop paying your taxes and you'll find out how free you are.
Right.
All right, so Samuel warned the people that they would be oppressed by their king and would cry out to God, but he would not hear them. This is the crazy thing. Samuel tells them all these terrible things which they were not currently experiencing. I mean, you're going to be drafted into the military. Your daughters are going to be drafted. He's going to take your land. He's going to take 10% of your income. You're going to be his servants. All these horrible things. And if this isn't bad enough, then he tells the people all this stuff, and they're still going to go along with it. Well, and furthermore, he tells them that when it happens, you're going to cry out to God, and God's not going to hear you. And they're still like, sign me up. Verse 18. "And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which he shall have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." You know, I'm sure we're all familiar with Proverbs chapter 1, and that's where we're going to go. When God warns us, and we don't listen. When our judgment comes and we cry to him, he doesn't answer. Look at Proverbs 1, 24 through 32. There comes a point where God, his ear is open to the cry of the righteous. But then after a while, when he keeps telling him, and he gives you his book, and he gives you preaching and everything, and you still want to just go do it your way, eventually God says, okay, go ahead. But when you call unto me, I'm not going to be here anymore. Verse 24 through 32 of Proverbs 1. Says, "Because I have called and ye refused, I have stretched out my hand and no man regarded. But ye have set it not on my counsel and would none of my reproof. I will laugh at your calamity. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh. When your fear cometh as desolation, and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind. When distress and anguish cometh upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. Then shall they seek me. Then they shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would none of my counsel. They despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices." Think about the kid whose parents have told him, don't have sex before you're married. Don't fornicate. The word of God tells him, flee fornication. He hears it over and over again, and he does it, and before you know it, he gets an STD or something. And then he cries out to God, "Lord, have mercy on me." And God says, "You know what? I told you many times. You didn't listen. Now you're going to eat of the fruit of your own way." This has happened to our country. We turn our back on God, and wisdom repeatedly cries and cries and cries. And eventually, when we're finally taken over and ransacked, and who knows what happens to us, then all of a sudden everybody's going to cry unto God. Then all of a sudden you're going to have all these foxhole believers. You know, once there are no atheists in foxholes, right? And then God says, "You know what? It's too late. It's too late. I've already been crying for so long. You're going to eat of the fruit of your own way now. Repent before the cup of iniquity is full." Because when the cup gets full, he's done. When God's people won't listen to him, he gives them up unto their own heart's lust. Look at Psalm 81 and verse 11 through 12. This is what's happening. I mean, Samuel has warned Israel. He's told them of these dire consequences. And they say, "Yep, just we want it anyway." And God says, "Okay, you're going to get your own heart's lust." Psalm 81, 11 through 12. It says, "But my people would not hearken to my voice, and Israel would none of me." That's exactly what happened. They wouldn't hearken to his voice through Samuel. They didn't want any of him. He was already their king, and they didn't want him. Remember, God says, they have not rejected thee, but they've rejected me. "But my people would not hearken to my voice, and Israel would none of me. So I gave them up unto their own heart's lusts, and they walked in their own counsels." If they'd only listened, God would have subdued their enemies. Look at the next two verses, 13 and 14. Oh, that my people had hearkened unto me, and Israel had walked in my ways. I should soon have subdued their enemies and turned my hand against their adversaries. This is the very reason why they wanted a king. Remember, the king of the nations came up against them and they said, make us a king to go out before us. They didn't listen to Samuel's warning. God gives them up to their own lust, and God says, if they would have just listened, I would have delivered them out of the hand of that king. Do you remember what happened in 1 Samuel 7? If you listen to the Bible study the last 2 weeks, we went through that. What happened? Israel cries out to God. Samuel tells them to put away Balaam and Ashtoreth, and they do that. They humble themselves, they fast, they pray, and then God saves them out of the hand of their enemies. It just happened in the previous chapter. It would have happened again. God would have taken care of them again. But they let their fear get the best of them. Now, despite the warning, Israel still wants a king. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 19. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 19. Oh boy, I got a verse for you that I just forgot about. But before I forget, let me just flip back here and find it, and then I'll make that point. It's in the Proverbs. Oh, no, I won't be able to find it. Anyway. Oh, here it is. I got it. Okay. So anyway, chapter 8, 1 Samuel 8 and verse 19. It says, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, but we will have a king over us. Now, look over. There's the verse I was just thinking about. Look over in Proverbs 29 and verse 1. It says, he that being often reproved hardeneth his neck, shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. When a person is reproved often, and he continues to harden his neck, he will suddenly be destroyed. The reproof comes gradually. The destruction comes suddenly. You don't know when the cup of iniquity is full, so take the reproof. It says that fools despise wisdom and instruction. This is what they're doing. Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7. It says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. I didn't get to it, but that's what it says anyway. Samuel had spoken into the ears of fools, but they would not receive his words. Look at Proverbs 23 and verse 9. Proverbs 23 and verse 9. Says, speak not into the ears of a fool, for he will despise the wisdom of thy words. You're wasting your time. Whenever somebody has proven themselves to be a fool, don't waste your time speaking into their ears anymore. That's why I quit going to that atheist meetup group. Speak not into the ears of a fool, lest he despise the wisdom of thy words. And furthermore, you get yourself a blot, it says in Proverbs chapter 9. They'll turn again like a sow and rend you. Don't waste your time with people like that once they've proven themselves to be a fool. Cease, my son, to hear the instruction of them which causeth thee to err from the words of knowledge. There's another proverb. There's another one right on the tip of my tongue, and I can't remember it. Cease, my son, to hear the instruction that causeth thee to err from the words of wisdom is another one. They wanted to be like the nations. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 20. I should tell you to keep your finger there in 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 20. That we also may be like all the nations. So they wanted to be like them. They didn't want to be some second-rate nation with some judges or something. We got to have a king. We got to be like, you know, like the rest of them. And they wanted to be warmongers and have their king take them to war. Look at the second half of the verse. And that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. They're a bunch of neocons. God says, all right, you want to go to war? Fine, you'll go to war. So Samuel told God what they said, and God said to listen to them and give them their king. Verse 21 and 22. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, go ye every man unto his city. So God says, well, go ahead. You've told them. You warned them. You even told them that whenever this happens and you turn to God, he's not going to hear you. And after all that, they said, nope, we want a king. And God says, okay, fine. Tell them that they're going to get their king. Wisdom had cried to them. They had refused. Now God is going to give them up to their own desires as a judgment against them. We saw that in Proverbs 1, 30 and 31. Now get this, though. The Lord is still merciful. Nevertheless, if they and their king would fear God and obey his voice and not rebel against him, it would still go well with them. Turn to 1 Samuel 12, 12 through 15. So despite all this stuff, you would think if I put myself into the shoes of God and my people had rejected me from being their king, and then I had warned them about all these things that are going to happen, and that when they happen and you cry unto me, I'm not even going to help you. And after all that, they still say, nope, we want a king. You'd think, you know what, I'm done with you, and I'm just going to destroy you, no matter what you do. But that's not how God, that's not what God said here. Look at what it says in 1 Samuel 12, 12 through 15. It says, and when ye saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, ye said unto me, nay, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord God was your king. Now therefore, behold the king whom ye have chosen, and whom ye have desired, and behold, the Lord hath set a king over you. And look at this. If ye will fear the Lord, and serve him, and obey his voice, and not rebel against his commandment of the Lord, then shall both ye and also the king that reigneth over you continue following the Lord your God. But if ye will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall the hand of the Lord be against you as it was against your fathers. So despite all of this, if they would still follow the Lord and their king, who ended up being Saul, the Lord would still have prospered them and he would have been just fine. It's as if they did something completely contrary to what he told them, and he told them the judgment that would result in that. But he says, you know what? If you still follow me and obey me, it's going to go well with you. That's pretty merciful. Now, maybe you have made a boneheaded decision against the pastor's counsel, but maybe you continue to serve the Lord and wasn't the best idea, but yeah, maybe he'll continue to bless you just like he said he would bless Israel. But I wouldn't use that as an excuse to make a boneheaded decision in the future. You're going to tempt God eventually if you keep going down that road. So in conclusion, once again, the issue is not so much about the type of government that we have, but it's about the character of the people and of the rulers. And in this is the case. God tells them, look here, having a human king is a bad idea, but if you and your king follow me, it's going to go well with you. So hey, a monarchy would be fine if you had a good and godly people with a good and godly king. So would a republic, for that matter, or a democracy. I suppose even an anarcho-society, an anarchy would go just fine. If you had good and godly people, you wouldn't even need any government, right? But if you have a wicked people, then you're going to have a wicked government. Now remember that even though a monarchy and a republic would work if people are godly, remember this, that God's original form of government was a system in which he was king and human government was local and distributed. That's how it was in the judges, in the days of the judges. It was localized. You know, there were 12 tribes of Israel and they were kind of spread out and men judged their own tribes, and Moses had rulers of 50s and 100s and things like that. And so that was God's original plan. Distribute it, make government at more of a local level, and have God as the king and the ruler. There's less chance for despotism and more chance for liberty under God's original system, is what I would say. So thank you for listening this morning, and may God bless this to your understanding and to his glory.